This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For democracy to function properly, voters must trust the election process. Is the vote tally a reflection of the will of the people or the result of something underhanded? Technology-related blunders, administrative incompetence, voter suppression tactics, divisive rhetoric, misinformation campaigns, and other foreign interference, all of this, whether real or imagined, makes voters increasingly question the fairness and accuracy of U.S. elections. At the Iowa caucuses in early February, official results were delayed due to inconsistencies between paper documentation and a new minimally tested app, which ironically was intended to streamline vote tallies. But internal inconsistencies are not new in American elections. Confusion about hanging chads rattled voter confidence during the 2000 presidential election, and ultimately the Supreme Court determined that victor, and even the way the High Court acted was not without some questions of legitimacy and partisan hackery. Foreign interference played a big role in the 2016 and 2018 elections, fears which have resurfaced this cycle, as little has been done to prevent future cyber attacks on U.S. election systems or effectively manage the ever-growing social media misinformation ecosystem. As the November election becomes closer, what can be done to prepare for worst-case scenarios? What are the most likely threats to the U.S. voting system? And if an election meltdown does occur, how could that fallout affect Americans' faith in democracy? And what can be done to rebuild trust in the American democratic process? Richard L. Hansen writes about these problems and how the nation could protect itself in the book Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press.
Well, I do think that it's a combination of things that's caused Americans to have less trust in the fairness and accuracy of our election system. And even having this discussion right now can cause people to wonder whether or not there might be problems. But I do think it's important to have this discussion now, you know, where we've still got a number of months before the election where we could come in and try to make things better. And I'm really hoping that as we focus on the way that things might go wrong, either through incompetence or through, you know, bad actors trying to mess with our system, that we can put in place certain procedures and certain rules that might minimize the chance that we have a problem come November.
What kind of problems do you think that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, there are a number of different things that could go wrong. So you kind of can think about nightmare scenarios, you know, what kind of things go wrong? And then you can work backwards from there and ask, well, what might we do to try to minimize the chance that this will actually be a disaster? So let me spin one out for you, one that I talk about in my book, Election Meltdown. Imagine that it's a very close race and it comes down to a swing state like Wisconsin or Michigan. And imagine that there's a cyber attack from the Russians or some other outside group that takes down the power grid in Detroit or Milwaukee on election day. So you're talking about hitting a Democratic city in a swing state, something that would inevitably create all kinds of chaos where there's, you know, the potential for voting to be disrupted and for it to actually affect the outcome of the presidential election. Well, there's not much that you or I could do to stop a cyber attack like that. I mean, that's really the job of the federal government, and I hope that they're doing everything they can to prevent that. But we can try to insist that states pass rules or Congress pass rules to deal with what happens if there's a cyber attack or some other kind of attack or natural disaster that hits us on election day. I mean, it's much better to try to figure out what the rules should be in advance than to try to create the rules when we know that whatever rule we pick could help one candidate and hurt another. So I'm really hoping that, you know, in this hyper-polarized atmosphere, we do as much planning and clarifying of rules before we get to the point where people are really going to fight over those rules in the case of a close election and not accept whatever a decision maker ends up choosing as a rule and see that as somehow as illegitimate.
But is this new? These types of shenanigans, who should be awarded these offices? This has been going on forever.
Well, I, you know, yes and no. I mean, I do think that we have had problems in our elections in isolated pockets. You know, we had in 2018, for example, the ballot tampering with absentee ballots that occurred in the North Carolina 9th U.S. Congressional District. And so that was a race where the State Board of Election unanimously held that there had to be a do-over election. So problems do happen, but they're pretty rare in modern times. And, you know, our elections are pretty clean, and for the most part, they're well run. But right now, I think things are different for two reasons. One, we're in a very hyper-polarized moment in our politics where the other side, whatever side you're on, the other side is really demonized and, you know, seen as the enemy. The people are really, you know, it's not just, you know, a polite adversary relationship. People take their politics very seriously, and it's very strongly divided now. And second, social media tends to exacerbate people's emotions and tensions, and also tends to insulate people from different points of view. You tend to be in your silo, and you get information from people and groups that you already agree with. And so I think the combination of these two factors create the conditions where not just, say, a small election or a local election could be subject to some kind of questioning because of, you know, some dirty trick that someone pulled somewhere. But we're now in a situation where, you know, large percentages of the American population, no matter what happens in November, are going to be severely disappointed with the outcome, right? So it's going to be 47, 48% of the population that's really upset. If something goes wrong in the election, and there's a plausible way to claim that it was because of some wrongdoing or because of some incompetence, people are going to want to latch onto that. And they're going to want to try to reverse the apparent outcome of the election. So it's a very volatile time. And I think because we're in this period, it's not just a single isolated election, but the, you know, the very control of the presidency that could potentially be at stake.
What about the role of a very well-disciplined, well-funded machine that is determined to discredit Western democracy? And I'm talking about Vladimir Putin and his efforts to basically say elections don't work.
Well, I think that certainly we know that the Russians tried to interfere with the 2016 elections. They tried to do so in three different ways, according to the Mueller report and according to the reports of the U.S. intelligence agencies. One thing was the spread of misinformation, as well as the spread of not necessarily incorrect information, but information meant to rile us up and send us to our opposing corners. They stole emails from Democratic operatives and leaked them in ways to embarrass Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And they engaged in probing of the voter registration databases across the country. They did, as far as we know, they didn't do anything that really changed any election results. But what they did do was cause people to wonder whether or not something could have been messed with. And I think that has been Putin's playbook all along, to throw enough doubt on the process so that people can't believe what they read, they can't believe what they hear, and they come to mistrust everything. And so this time around, I don't think it's just going to be Putin, but it could be other inside and outside actors that try to manipulate us with misinformation, that try to undermine people's confidence in the process. I mean, just look at the Iowa Democratic Party's caucus that melted down. And you may remember there, right after the party announced that they were not going to immediately issue the results of the election because there were some technical problems. We all know that, you know, they had a big problem with their app and with their calculation of all of the votes. But you had the president's campaign manager claiming that this was, you know, deliberate rigging of the election to hurt Bernie Sanders. And I think it's those kinds of statements that really undermine people's confidence in the process and give people a sense, a wrong sense, that elections are being routinely rigged and stolen. And so I think that it's not just Putin. Putin, you know, put out his playbook, and certainly the Russians were bad actors in 2016, and I expect them to be bad actors in 2020. But they're by far not the only actors who could be trying to affect election outcomes through the kind of social manipulation.
one thing in the Iowa caucuses. There was a phone number that these caucuses captains were supposed to call in the results. And that number was posted online and was circulated in areas, and people were saying, call the number, keep it busy, flood the zone, and don't let this number work. And we heard from a caucus captain saying they could never get through to call in the results. Something like that you're talking about?
Sure. I mean, that's just another example of a dirty trick. And that's meant to take advantage of an already unfortunate situation and make it worse. And unfortunately, we have to be on guard against bad actors. You know, it should have started by not having the party that's running this caucus roll out these brand new untested ways of trying to calculate the vote without more testing and without backup plans that were actually going to work. If you're going to have a backup phone number, the last thing you need to be doing is publicizing it. And that's, you know, just like kind of another example of where bad actors can piggyback on some problems and make them seem even worse than they already are.
Do you think that we could, by raising awareness that elections can be messed up, they can take more than one day, we're not going to have a news anchor give us the results at 10 p.m. that evening and tell us who won or who didn't win or whatever. We just have to generally learn that it's going to take longer than that. Society has to develop a tolerance for this to build up our trust.
I certainly think that people need to change their expectations about how long it takes to get election results, in part because more people are voting from home with absentee ballots, and those absentee ballot envelopes take a long time to process to make sure that people are eligible to vote when they send them in. It may be that it takes a day or two, or sometimes, as we saw in the 2018 congressional elections in California, it sometimes might take weeks to determine the winner when the election is close enough. The other thing that we saw, and California again is an example of this, is that if Democrats are going to continue to take advantage, for example, of trying to bring in more early voters and absentee voters than Republicans are, that vote totals may shift. That Republicans in some places might look like they're winning on election night, but by the time all the ballots are totaled, the result is to favor the Democrats. Or, of course, in certain places, it could go the other way. So I think people need to be educated that what happens, what's announced on election night with preliminary totals is not the final result. And the media need to be very careful not to do extra early calling of races before there's a chance to make sure that, enough votes have been counted to know whether we're confident who the winner and the loser is.
Richard L. Hansen is the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. We're taking a quick break and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Richard L. Hansen about his book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Hansen is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. In 2013, he was named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal, and his previous books include Voting Wars, Plutocrats United, and The Justice of Contradictions.
Typically, in our recent history, we would have our leaders behave in a very mature fashion, that they would have election night, they would be able to tell which way the wind is blowing, and they would have a very orderly concession speech, and we would move along and try to have a transition of power that we could all be proud of. Live the fight another day. There'll be another election, so we can keep on working towards the battle of ideas in that fashion. Is that over?
I do think that's over. And in fact, imagine someone wants to do the statesmanlike thing. Today in social media, they would be excoriated for giving up the fight. You know, there's too much at stake because we're so polarized. The idea that you would give up without fighting every last possible way to try to gain a political advantage, that's seen as wrong. And so I think that conduct, whether it's Al Gore in 2000 conceding after the Supreme Court issued its decision in Bush versus Gore, or it's Richard Nixon in 1960 conceding, even though there were serious questions about the vote counting in Illinois, potentially Hawaii, those people were maybe seen as engaging in something larger than themselves. And, you know, that's kind of celebrated as heroic. Today, I think it would be the opposite. With the stakes this high, you can't concede. You must fight till the bitter end.
Was there a downside to having that fight to the bitter end? We're never going to concede. I mean, we're now seeing that becoming the pattern where these people who don't win say, I'm not going to concede. I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, no, I think that is just really, a tough situation, because you do want to have an election process that produces a fair winner. You don't want people to give up when there's still a chance of winning. But on the other hand, you want to have finality to a process, and you want people to be accepting enough that as a loser, that they can just, as you said, agree to fight another day. And so, you know, where that line is, I think it becomes very difficult when we're so hot on social media and there's so much anger in the polity right now, that, you know, people making rational decisions that might make sense for the long term are seen as, you know, somehow traitorous for the short term. And so, you know, I think one of the ways to try to deal with this kind of problem is to cut off the paths by which someone could try to contest an election on weak grounds. So, for example, if the you know, the question is, you know, were the voting machines hacked? You know, somebody claims, I lost because in this place the voting machines were hacked, a claim being made without evidence. Well, if the jurisdiction has in place a procedure by which they can audit their votes with a hand recount, where people can actually look at the ballots and they can determine that the results that were announced on election night actually match what's on a piece of paper that's tangible that people can actually read, then it becomes much less plausible for a candidate to make a spurious claim that you know, the vote totals were hacked, right? But if the jurisdiction does not have in place a procedure for conducting a recount of ballots, an audit of ballots to make sure that the vote count is accurate, then it becomes much easier for someone who's unscrupulous to make a claim, like a claim that there's some kind of hacking that took place in the system. So I think we really need to think about, how do we strengthen our systems in terms of transparency, in terms of clear rules, so that it's harder for someone who's on the wrong end of a close election to be able to make arguments for why the dispute over who won the election should be extended.
Do you think that there are people out there that they have lost faith in democracy and they just care about trying to gain power?
Well, so, I mean, that creates a deeper question, which is how committed are Americans to the democratic process itself? And I think in this moment in time, you know, there certainly is so much tribalism, particularly within the Republican Party and its, you know, its current allegiance to Donald Trump, that there are questions as to whether or not democratic values are paramount over support of the party. So to give one example, I had a piece recently in Slate magazine where I counted up the 27 times that President Trump had joked or otherwise remarked about staying in office beyond his constitutionally limited 2 terms in office, you know, 16 more years, 12 more years. And Trump jokes about it. I said 27 times. I produced a spreadsheet. Within a week, I think we were up to 30 times, because he continues to make this kind of joke. But I do think that that corrodes democratic values when you're joking about staying in power, when you're attacking the press as the enemy of the people, when you're attacking other government institutions like the courts or the FBI. I think those kinds of things undermine the kind of checks that we have on presidential power and lead people to be more to have more allegiance to a particular person or political party than they do to the democratic system. So I am worried that we are in a moment right now where some people are so adamant in terms of the belief in the rightness of their side that they're willing to put democratic and rule of law values as a secondary concern. But, you know, that goes beyond the question that I'm addressing in my book, Election Meltdown, about how do we ensure that we have a a fair and safe election in 2020 and beyond. But they're related in the sense that a democracy depends on the losers accepting the results as legitimate. But if you don't care about democratic values, then that question is of less importance to you.
Right. You write that you're not that concerned with Donald Trump because after Donald Trump, there will be other elections.
Well, what I say is that Trump is more of a symptom than the disease. He has done some things that are way beyond what any other president or presidential candidate has done. For example, he claimed without any evidence whatsoever that millions of people voted fraudulently in the 2016 elections. Kind of an odd claim for the winner of the election to make. But this is because he had the Electoral College victory, but not the popular vote victory. And he claimed that about 3 million fraudulent votes were cast, about the same number that Hillary Clinton received, I think not coincidentally. He also told ABC's David Muir that all of the illegal votes were cast for his opponent. I mean, these are just outrageous statements that are not backed up by any facts whatsoever. In an election meltdown, I talk about what the evidence of voter fraud is. And there are some cases of voter fraud, but they tend to be very small and isolated and not on the kind of scale that could go without detection, like something like millions of votes. And you know, I go through that evidence in great detail for your listeners who might be skeptical. So Trump is, I think, uniquely bad in making unsubstantiated claims and in riling up his base by not only claiming voter fraud, but by encouraging his supporters to go to polling places to watch other communities where he suspects that voter fraud is taking place. I think that creates potentially dangerous conditions. But these problems existed before Donald Trump. They'll exist after Donald Trump leaves the scene. And so this is not something that he created or something that will disappear when he's no longer on the scene.
Right, but Donald Trump is the president now, and we're in a re-election cycle with him in it, and he's making these pretty broad claims that have no basis in fact. And he's saying all these things about not leaving office. What I'm wondering about, and we have no idea what's going to happen. We don't know who the Democratic nominee is going to be. It's all up in the air. But we have the election on November the 3rd this year, and November the 4th, maybe we'll know what the outcome will be. And then we have a couple of months before we have inauguration. So we have 2 months of a lame duck presidency with Donald Trump. And maybe the winner of the election, who knows? I'm just speculating. I'm not advocating for anything. Maybe it's going to be Bernie Sanders. And he could use that time to gin up his own sort of counter-narrative and bring up concerns about he doesn't want to hand over the keys to the White House, the power of the presidency, to someone that he considers to be a socialist. And we could have a crisis. Have you thought about that?
Sure. You know, that one of the most common questions I get when I've been touring around talking about my book, Election Meltdown, is what if Trump won't leave office? And, you know, it's very hard to answer that question in the abstract. What I have to say is it depends on the strength of our other institutions, should it come to that. Many people believe even asking the question is preposterous. Of course, Trump would abide by the rule of law. Yet others see his behavior in other contexts and believe that he wouldn't. And really, it doesn't come down in that circumstance where there's a clear winner and the Congress has actually accepted the Electoral College votes and declared someone else besides Trump the president. If Trump won't leave office at that point, you would think that leaders in Congress, public intellectuals, the military, everyone would just find a way to get Trump out of power. That situation, I mean, it seems to me hard to imagine that Trump actually doesn't leave under those circumstances. Much more likely is a protracted battle where Trump has never conceded, and there's still a claim being made on the Republican side that he's actually the winner of the election rather than the loser. I mean, that seems to me a more plausible way for this to roll out. But, you know, the fact that we're even having discussions like this shows you how far our politics have deteriorated in the last decade or so. I recall back in January of 2009, when George W. Bush, a conservative Republican, handed power over to Barack Obama, a liberal Democrat, and you know, it was a moment of celebration. It was like there was never any question, is Bush going to leave the White House, right? No one talked about that. It was just assumed that that would happen. And if Obama lost to Romney in 2016. Did anyone think that Obama would fight to stay in the office? You know, of course not. And so I think things have really gotten to a very low place in our politics where we're having this discussion about a president who might not leave office in the event he loses.
And the center point, the fulcrum of that will be trying to attack the legitimacy of the election.
Absolutely. And so that's why we need to harden our election systems. We need to make sure that our legal infrastructure, our political infrastructure, our cyber infrastructure, that all of these things are as secure as they could possibly be, so that claims that might be made that there was something wrong with how the election was conducted can be easily dismissed by most people. The more evidence there is of a clear and transparent process, the better off we're going to be.
So you're asking for a clear and transparent process. And I don't know how that would work, because typically I go vote and I turn on the TV and I see what the count is and, you know, you go with that.
Sure. Right. So one point that I make is that as voters, we have a responsibility to ensure that systems are transparent. You think, well, how can you do that? Well, it turns out, you know, we don't have a single election for president. We have something like 8,000 or 9,000 elections for president because we conduct our elections on a county or sub-county level. So that means that everyone has a local election official. There's a local election board, or there's someone who's in charge of elections. And they have rules about how they do things. If you are concerned about these things, you can inquire as to what those rules are. You can go and watch the ballot counting. You can ask questions about whether or not there's a procedure for a recount in the event that there's a close election, or to make sure that the voting machine totals that are announced actually match what's said. And so this is what I mean by an open and transparent process. It doesn't mean that everyone has to watch, but if enough voters are concerned, and I hear lots of concern from voters, then people can step up and they can observe and they can see what it is that might be done to try to make the election process one in which there's clarity about what was done, how the vote counting was done, and how the you know, the ultimate winner was chosen.
Not everything that goes wrong at an election is done by with nefarious intent. Sometimes you just have incompetence. I mean, how do you factor that?
Well, sure. And so I think, and I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying you're much more likely to be disenfranchised by incompetence than by voter suppression or voter fraud. That if you're really, you know, thinking about what's at the top of the list, there are these pockets of incompetent election administrators. This is another thing that needs to be done. Voters need to pay attention to who's running their elections. Brenda Snipes, who I mentioned earlier, was the election official in Broward County, Florida, who didn't do a good job in terms of the counting of votes. She was reelected to office as a Democrat numerous times, even though she had a track record of performing poorly in running her elections. And so it's up to voters to pay attention. If there are long lines in your polling places, election after election, if there are problems with vote totals, if there are problems with recounts, then that's a signal that something is broken and that voters need to demand accountability and make sure that those who are running elections are either retrained or replaced.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking with Richard Hansen about his book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. The conversation continues after this quick break.
Support for this podcast comes from Sunshine Cottage's Noche del Sol, a fiesta kickoff event with Mexican food, entertainment, and Delaritas, plus a raffle and auctions to benefit the School for Deaf Children, March 26th, 6 p.m. More at sunshinecottage.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The question of who will be the Democratic nominee for the 2020 presidential election could be settled today, depending on what happens this Super Tuesday. But already there is widespread distrust about what's happening with delegates, superdelegates, vote rigging, last-minute endorsements, and concerns of a brokered convention. All of this could be playing into the hands of those who seek to weaken democracy. Baseless, inflammatory rhetoric about stolen elections supercharges distrust among hardcore partisans, and it turns off many from voting at all. Let's get back to the conversation with Richard Hansen, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy.
Is voter suppression also a concern? For example, we had like Stacey Abrams, who did not win the governor's race in Georgia. She's saying that her victory was stolen from her, but I don't know if that actually happened.
So I think, you know, there are a few things to say. Number one, I believe a lot of these laws that make it harder to register and vote are intended to suppress the votes of Democrats, even though they often don't have that effect. So I think, for example, voter ID laws, for a number of reasons, which we can talk about, tend to not have as much of a suppressive effect as many Democrats and those on the left feared. There are other suppressive laws that have more of an effect. For example, I talk about an election meltdown, a law that was passed in Kansas that said that you couldn't register to vote unless you provided documentary proof of citizenship, like your birth certificate or your naturalization papers. And we know that 30,000 people had their voter registrations put on hold. They couldn't go and vote until a federal court put in an injunction and barred the use of this procedure. So suppression is real. These laws don't prevent an appreciable amount of voter fraud. And again, if you're skeptical of that claim, you should read my book, Election Meltdown, where I explain in detail why I make that determination. The intent is suppressive. It doesn't always have a suppressive effect. But saying that someone is trying to make it harder for you to register and vote is not the same thing as saying an election is stolen. So when Stacey Abrams said that she did not accept Brian Kemp as a legitimate governor of Georgia, or when Sherrod Brown said that Kemp stole the election, that invites an argument over whether the suppressive things that Kemp did, and Kemp did suppressive things, he did things that made it harder for people to register and vote, that those things actually affected the election outcome. A relatively close election between Abrams and Kemp. Kemp was the Secretary of State who was not just running the election, he was running in the election. He did some bad things, but you know, there's no social science that you can point to actually show that if he hadn't, for example, put in this exact match law about you know, what kind of ID, what, how your ID needs to match the name that's on your registration.
The signatures.
Right. Yes, right. So if you had a hyphen in your name, but that wasn't the way it appeared on the voter registration roll, you wouldn't be able to vote. Those kind of things. A lot of those things were softened before the election by court orders. But, you know, you end up having a debate over whether there's enough evidence to call the election stolen. Whereas I think that that distracts from the real point, which is, why is Kemp making it harder for some people to register and vote? So it's perfectly fine to say that Kemp was engaged in suppressive activities. It's perfectly fine to say that he should not be both running and running in his election. But when you start throwing around the rhetoric of stolen elections, I think then you're in a different place. And then I think that becomes problematic, because when you convince people that elections can be stolen and that that's what's going on, that that creates a that undermines voters' confidence in the process and makes it even harder to get people to vote, because why should I vote if the whole system is rigged? And so I think it's almost self-defeating to make these kinds of claims.
But we've with Senator Bernie Sanders, when he ran for the Democratic nomination in 2016 against Hillary Clinton and he didn't win, we saw a lot of memes, a lot of activity online, Facebook stuff, basically trying to tear down Hillary Clinton for that fact that Bernie Sanders didn't win the election, so therefore we should sit out the not vote for her in the general election. A lot of people have said that was generated by the Russian propaganda machine to drive down the vote. But it shows how grievances can be turned into real or imagined into ways to dampen voter turnout. Is that voter manipulation? Is that hacking the vote?
Right. So it depends on what you think is, you know, a reasonable kind of discourse. And politics can be nasty. I think where things cross the line is when you make factual statements that cannot be proven. So if you make a claim about someone engaging in some kind of activity and that statement is false, then you're engaging in misinformation. I don't think that there is a I don't think we could have a law against candidates saying false things, because it would be very difficult to know who should police that. You know, we're going to punish someone for false speech. And those states that have experimented with it, I think it becomes troubling. And so we really have to depend upon counter speech in the political process to ferret those kinds of things out. But I think it's really incumbent on us to do that. So when you see someone making a false statement, whether it's a candidate, a party, or anyone else, that could potentially affect the election, you need to pay attention and see whether those statements are true or not. And I know that the social media companies have started going down the road of providing fact checks. So if on Facebook, for example, you're going to go through some kind of sharing of information that has been found to be misinformation, it'll now be flagged and you'll be pointed to a fact check. I mean, I think that's a good way to try to deal with these things. There's going to be a lot of misinformation coming in 2020. There's no question about that. So people need to be on guard. They need to realize that not everything that they see posted is going to be true. And before you start circulating things, you need to ask yourself, you know, how reliable a source is this? Because people, of course, tend to be more likely to want to share something that fits in with their pre-existing beliefs about the way the world should be. You know, so if you don't like a particular candidate and you see something negative about that candidate, you're going to be much more apt to share it than if you see something negative about a candidate that you support.
Are voters going to get smarter about this, or will they also hold politicians to a tougher standard, maybe? The way for democracy to work is for the voters to hold their politicians accountable.
Well, I do think that, you know, one likely effect of all of this misinformation that's floating out there is voters are going to become more cynical, and they're going to believe that all the information that is out there is false. And so without valid intermediaries to help us figure out what's true and false, we're going to rely more on our emotions, you know, and so that's a kind of a bad situation to be in. I think kind of the whole misinformation problem is one of pollution, right? When there's so much pollution floating around, it's really hard to, you know, find the non-polluted parts of the sea, right? And so I hope that there'll be some technological solutions, but also I think voters need to figure out who are my reliable sources for information, you know, whether that's NPR or something else. Where do I go to find information that's true? And, you know, that, you know, when politicians say something and they're subject to a fact check, I think that matters. Even President Trump, who has been called out many times for making false statements, he seems to be very sensitive to, you know, getting four Pinocchios from the Washington Post, for example. And so I think the politicians do care when they're called out for their false statements. And most politicians care more than Trump does about making false statements. And I think making sure that, you know, the media is fact-checking what politicians say is, you know, a good way to try to preserve people's ability to be able to tell the difference between what's true and what's not true.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. After this break, we continue the conversation with Richard Hansen, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and a Threat to American Democracy. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm talking about keeping our elections safe and secure with Richard Hansen, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and a Threat to American Democracy.
So who should be leading the conversation about trying to rebuild trust? Where should that be coming from?
Well, because the problems in our election are so multifaceted, the solutions are multifaceted as well. So it's up to each party or entity involved in the election process to come forward with their potential ways of trying to make things better. The news media has a role to play. Local election administrators have a role to play. Congress has a role to play. And so I think it falls to each of these different groups and agencies to come forward and think about what can we do to make it more likely that we'll have a free and fair election where people are confident that even if their side did not win the election, that the election was conducted in a fair enough way that the results are legitimate.
This red versus blue type of way of thinking about things, that everything has got to be partisanized, trying to restore a middle ground in America? I mean, could that be a step forward, trying to restore democratic ideals?
I certainly think that if we were less polarized, it would be easier to solve these problems. Or if we were not in this moment of technological upheaval in terms of how we get our information. If there were a way to move more people towards bipartisan solutions, I think that would spill over into the election arena. It's just hard to know how you get there from here. It might take some kind of extrinsic shock to our system to realign things. Right now, we seem to be moving in an ever more partisan direction, at least if you look at how Congress and the branches of government on the state level have been working.
Yeah, the shock to the system, that doesn't sound very, I wouldn't look forward to that, because last I can think of when we've had that before, and it was like maybe a civil war or something?
Well, war is one thing that could be a shock to the system. I would have thought that Bush versus Gore would have been enough of a shock to the system to have convinced people that we need to get our electoral act together. But apparently that was not enough of a shock to get us moving. It could be demographic change. It could be an external threat. It could be, lots of different things. It's really hard to know what the future brings. But I'm certainly hoping that we're going to pass to an era when we're not quite as partisan as we are today.
I mean, we have these attitudes. You hear them all the time. Hillary is Satan, or Trump is Satan. You know, how do you compromise with evil? And that seems to be the problem. How can we back away from that? Do we start looking at the problems of people rather than the politics?
Yeah, so now I think you're getting into a much deeper question than the one I ask in my book, which is just about legitimacy of our elections. And you're asking just how can we become a less partisan country? I don't see how we become a less partisan country in the short term. And my book is aimed at asking, given that we have this great extent of partisanship, do we have a means to ensure that our rules are clear and transparent enough, our results are sufficient enough that even in this atmosphere, the losers will begrudgingly accept the results and just decide that it's time to fight for the next election.
The Senate has not taken up or did not pass bills that would have provided more funding for election security. What do you take away from that?
Well, the Senate eventually did pass an election security measure. It was less money than the House had requested. But there is money coming in. I don't think that money is the primary issue, although certainly more money would be welcome. I think that, on questions of cybersecurity, the number one thing I would like to see right now is for the president to come out strongly and say that he's against all foreign interference and that he will treat foreign interference by Russia or some other countries that might interfere as an attack on the United States, and the United States will respond accordingly.
What we're seeing. So now, what would you like to see?
So ideally, I'd like to see that. But what I hope is happening is that at levels below the president and the executive branch, that the federal government, state governments, and local governments are cooperating on ways of ensuring that our election infrastructure and our general infrastructure is secure from attack in a way that might impact our elections.
Given that Donald Trump and some in his administration could face criminal indictment once they're out of office, that kind of raises the stakes that they may not want to leave office.
Sure, that's certainly possible. I think one of the things that greatest chances of avoiding a meltdown is not stuff that we're going to do. It's if the election is not close. Because when the election's not close, then it's really harder to claim that the election was stolen. That's not really something in anyone's control. But that's why the chances of a meltdown in any election are relatively small. Because, you're right, we have an electoral college. It has to be really close in a state that matters to the electoral college outcome. So maybe it will be that we'll be in a situation where it's not so close that it can really be contested. And that will be what saves us this time. But it's just a ticking time bomb. And it's something we're going to need to fix if we don't do it this election sometime later on down the line.
What's the role of the media in trying to prevent an election meltdown?
I think there's a lot that the media could do. Among the most important things would be to educate the public that votes take time to count and that the delay does not mean that there's something nefarious going on, nor does a change in who has the lead mean that there's something nefarious going on. I think the media also need to make sure to fight against disinformation and to provide accurate information to voters and to serve as a trusted source that voters can rely upon when they're figuring out what what's in the voters' own interests. So the media have to remain honest brokers in the election and provide valuable information and not be seen as taking sides. We have much more of a partisan election system and a much more of a partisan media than we've had before. And so, you know, finding those honest brokers is really tough right now.
It's tough to be hard to be an honest broker these days. It seems like no matter what you do, you're going to be labeled one way or the other.
I think that's certainly true. And having been attacked by both sides, you know, maybe that means that I'm doing something right. Or, you know, maybe it means just half the people attacking me are wrong. I don't know. But it is tough to try to stake a ground that says that, you know, there are things that are being done on both sides that are problematic, even if they're not symmetrical. On the voter fraud, voter suppression issue, I certainly think that Republicans have been worse on the issue of incompetence. Most big cities are controlled by Democrats. So I think in terms of the number of voters affected, it's more likely to be a Democratic city where there are problems. But, you know, but making these claims is controversial, and some people don't want to hear it.
Is hope, optimism, faith in our system, these are things that, are they in short supply? What happened to it all?
So I think part of it is the party realignment that occurred from the Voting Rights Act until now has really sorted the parties into two very separate groups, which have different interests and different values. And, you know, there used to be many more people who had cross-cutting views on different things that, you know, in terms of a bucket of interest. Now you're much more likely, if you have a position on abortion, it's likely to correlate with your position on taxes and your position on guns. And that wouldn't necessarily be the case that those three things would have been correlated in the past. We've kind of sorted ourselves into different boxes. And then, you know, that makes it very easy to engage in a kind of tribal warfare. And so until we get out of that box, I think we're, you know, looking for second best solutions to deal with this very polarized era. I do think that there are bad actors out there who are, have their interests in power or in minimizing our power and are looking for ways to make things worse. And we have to make our system resilient so that we can resist it and we can preserve our democracy.
Richard Hansen is the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and a Threat to American Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.